Welcome to Recalculating America, a program dedicated to small business in America. Recalculating will help you, the American small business owner, build a new business or help you to grow your existing one. Each week, experts will give you useful information about starting your new business, and you will hear from professionals selected to help you grow your business. Your hosts are Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins. Don Mazzella is the editor-in-chief of the Small Business Digest and has many years of experience helping small businesses build and grow their businesses. Now he is sharing his ideas with you over the air. Dan Perkins is a registered investment advisor with 43 years' experience in managing money. He specializes in helping small business owners make their money work as hard as they do. Now, your host, Don Mazzella and Dan Perkins.
Good morning. Dan Perkins here, your co-host, along with Don Mazzella of Recalculating, a program dedicated to helping small business leaders like yourself increase profits. We draw our name from the best-selling book, which features the contributions of more than 100 presidents, experts, and leaders, all of whom offer ways to grow your small business, and is available at our website, recalculating.biz. Don?
Dan, good morning. You know, so much is happening in the market today, and so much is happening around the world. I thought we'd start off first with your commentary on small business and what's affecting them. What are your thoughts?
Well, this morning we had some earnings news from Goldman, which disappointed. It missed, rarely misses misses a quarter, but they missed this quarter. On top of that, we had a surprise announcement by Prime Minister May of England saying that she was going to call for an election in June, and the next general election wasn't due until 2020. And that bolstered the British pound, put the dollar under pressure, and our equity markets opened up, opened down, I should say, about 100 points. They've clawed back about 40 of those points. Then we have news that keeps coming out about what appears to be diminishing strength in the economy. The jobs number last week was probably affected more by weather conditions than anything else. In fact, Goldman said they thought that the number was underreported between 60 and 80,000, which would have taken it right to estimate at about 168 to 180. Interest rates in the intermediate term, the 10-year, which started the beginning of the year spiking to about 262 basis points, or 2.62%. We now find today they're down almost half a 1%, which seems strange with the Fed raising rates on the short end, that the intermediate and the 10-year and the 30-year would actually be falling in yield. Again, perhaps another signal that the bond investors think that maybe the economy is not going to be as robust. Other news came out yesterday is the Treasury Secretary is now thinking that tax reform will not happen by August. And as we get past August and we get into the waning months of the year, if we have no tax reform, it will have an adverse effect on small business. In that the uncertainty of what taxes they're going to pay. One of the things that's very important to take into consideration, Don, is that sometimes the Congress will pass legislation retroactively. So even though we may be looking at possible tax changes in the second half of 2017, it's possible that they could make them retroactive to January 1st. It's also possible that if nothing happens, that if that serious tax reform is addressed in 2018, it's also possible that if they can do something before April, that they could make adjustments on a retroactive basis. So I think that uncertainty is rising and certainty for small business. Now, I know that you know from your research that the number of small businesses available for sale is accelerating. And I don't know whether that's because people want to buy businesses or people want to sell business because they're retiring or what the opportunity is. But if there's a demand and people are selling, that tells me that prices must be going up for small business. The markets, as it relates to, for example, retirement accounts, the market is still pretty volatile. We are off, before today, we were off about 3% from the high. I think we could touch 5%, perhaps more. It wouldn't be unusual that a correction of 10% couldn't be in the cards. So what I'm trying to say is I think we're still in a volatile time. I think the biggest uncertainty overhanging the markets and what people want to do is what's going to happen with North Korea. We know that they tried some more missile launches over the weekend that failed. Now there is a great deal of speculation. Did they fail or were they sabotaged by somebody within the North Korean government? Were they sabotaged by China by hacking? Were they sabotaged by the United States by hacking? Nobody knows. My guess is that they probably should have subcontracted their missile construction to China because I think they probably had better technology than the North Koreans have. But it is the probably the biggest thing overhanging the markets and the decision-making process. Are we going to have nuclear war? That's a pretty heavy thing to try and digest. And as a result, I think some plans have been put on hold, waiting to see what's going to happen with North Korea. And if our monster in Syria is going to do anything more in terms of using chemical weapons. I think it was interesting over the weekend that John Kerry, the former Secretary of State, supported quietly, but supported Donald Trump's attack on Syria, thought it should be done. It's important to understand that people are moving in a different direction. And I'm going to sneeze, so I'm going to give it back to you. Excuse me. I apologize. I couldn't get the mute button fast enough.
You know, I just got word that our guest is having trouble calling in, so I'm going to try to get him on the phone for us. So Okay. Stand by and see if I can get him on the phone.
Okay.
Let's see.
So while you're doing that, let me talk to the audience. There was a really interesting announcement that came out yesterday from the former CEO of Microsoft, and he has put together a team of people who have taken all of the statistical data of the United States government and laid it out under the auspices of the Constitution, created in essence a 10K for America. I didn't get a chance to read all of it, but I read some of it this morning. What he's basically trying to say is that we need to take a look at what our priorities are, where we spend our money, and trying to figure out by helping people understand in simple English what's going on in the government and the decisions that are being made, and then allow the American people to decide, hopefully, whether they want to continue the policies or do they want to do something different. And I think that that's an interesting piece. It's several thousand pages long, and there are a whole bunch of people that put all the data together. But it's an interesting approach that we have a businessman for president, and a businessman has decided to look at the government from a business perspective in a filing requirement for the SEC. So it's interesting times. I did some more research on energy and the potential opportunity. We have only had a little over, let's say, 15 months with the ability to export crude oil and refined product out of the United States. Most recent data shows that we're exporting about 1 million barrels a day of crude oil and about 1.2 million barrels a day of diesel fuel and about 700,000 barrels of refined gasoline. And I did a little research to try and figure out what might have happened in the meeting between Donald Trump and the premier of China when they met at Mar-a-Lago. And I think that, well, it wasn't a formal deal. When you understand the numbers I'm about to give you, I can see where Mr. Trump could have some very interesting leverage with the prime minister of China. I did some research, and shockingly, I found that even though China does have a small oil capacity, they import about 60% of the crude oil that they need to run their country. On the other hand, they have a large coal sector, one of the largest in the world, but where it is and where it needs to go is on opposite ends of the country, and the transportation costs by train are quite expensive. And interesting, though, in the decision-making process of why they've decided to go outside the country to import coal is the fatality rate in Chinese coal mines is among the highest in the world. So the cost and the cost of human life. So now they import about 30 to 35% of their coal needs, and they expect coal to continue to grow dramatically as a source of generation of electrical power. So that's going to speak well for the businesses that are involved in oil and natural gas. If we can get Rex Tillerson to help open the Chinese market for American coal, that would create a great opportunity for the highly depressed coal area of the Appalachian region to be able, and other parts of the country, to be able to begin to export coal, not only to China, but again, if we look at the oil and natural gas needs of India, second largest population in the world, they too are net importers of coal and natural gas. And so we have not exported coal or natural gas to either of those countries, or oil, and I think there's an opportunity for export of energy from the United States to the Far East, and again, competing against OPEC, taking market share away. Any luck with our guest?
Not yet. We're still trying to get him on board. You're doing a job. It's called keeping the airways live while we wait for our guests.
Right. Energy is an important issue. With the uncertainty in Korea has driven up gold prices to a 6-month high. It's off a little bit this morning, and so the small business person is probably looking at the world news and trying to decide what it is they can expect over the next 12 to 24 months, and what commitment should they make, knowing there's uncertainty about the direction of the economy, and for that matter, understanding what the business opportunity is going to be going forward. I think that one of the interesting things that I've been watching is the collapse of the big box stores, especially in retail. Macy's closing 100 stores and Abercrombie and Fitch and others dramatically reducing or going out of business. Ralph Lauren closing its flagship store in New York. A lot of things going on in the patterns of how we as Americans spend our discretionary dollars. It isn't so much that we're not spending the same amount of dollars as that we're choosing to spend them in a different place. And that is on the internet through shopping places like Amazon. And so it's changing the patterns, and which is also creating a problem of employment as hundreds of thousands of people are being laid off from the retailers, trying to find jobs is very difficult because the smaller retails are struggling. And you have these mega malls where the anchors are closing their stores, leaving the minor tenants to try and subsist on the traffic that they can draw, with no longer having the big box stores being the draw. So we're seeing it. Go ahead.
Dan, I'm going to interrupt you just to ask a question and make a comment because you're doing such a great job while we're waiting for our next guest. But I saw a study over the weekend that indicates that entry-level jobs and retail jobs, which are really the backbone of young people, are seemingly going away and reducing. Walmart has reduced the number of new hires. How do you think that's going to affect small businesses? Is it going to make it easier for them to find good people to work for them, or make it harder?
Well, really, the real question that I think out of what you said that has to be addressed is, use the word good people. I heard a commentary over the weekend that talked about education in our country today. And the gentleman was talking about college education. And he said, if you have a child who is considering going to college and the title of his degree has the word studies in it, he's going to be living in your basement forever. Or she is. Because you're not going to find a job in the private sector, or for that matter, even in the government, with a degree that says, you know, studies. And I think that it really is an issue of what kind of people are we graduating, not only from college, but how equipped are the young people that are coming out of mainstream America public education able to handle any kind of a job? And I think that's a real issue. So I think that it's really the other thing. I think that small business is going to have a difficult time finding people who have both a work ethic and some kind of a basic fundamental foundation in education that makes them worth hiring. Small businesses are willing to take the risk for a new employee if they have certain basic skills or attitudes. But if you don't have basic fundamental math skills and you can't write, it becomes very difficult for a small business. What's happening, and you and I have talked about this, and I've seen it explode as I traveled 2 weekends ago up to New York, the kiosk mentality in McDonald's now seems to be sweeping the nation in terms of all the franchises are considering switching over to the franchise model, which is using a kiosk. And
Dan, I'm going to interrupt you. I think our guest has arrived. Ia, are you on the phone, on the line?
I'm on the line, Don. How are you?
Very good. Dan Perkins and I have been waiting for you with anxious breaths. Dan has done a terrific job of keeping the airwaves open. Our guest is Ia Lifshitz. He's celebrating. He's a fintech pioneer. I interviewed him 2.5 years ago when fintech was just an idea. And now he's celebrating his third year as a leading online provider of flexible and convenient working capital for financing small and medium-sized businesses. Ia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. This is Dan Perkins. How are you, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm sorry you had such difficulty getting into the program. Before we get started, would you be so kind as to to tell people how they can get a hold of you, your website, or an email address that they can reach you and your company?
Sure. Our company is Blue Vine, and our website is bluevine.com, blue like the color blue, and vine as in grapevine, one word, .com. And there's a phone number and on the website where people can call us. There's also a contact form. It's very easy to find us. We're always there in all channels.
So if I might ask, sir, what were you doing before you founded Blue Vine?
Before Blue Vine, I worked in venture capital out of Israel and Europe, and you know, I saw a lot of innovations in the fintech space, which got me the idea to start Blue Vine.
So you started about 3 years ago, and obviously you made it 3 years, which is critical. what's your success look like?
Absolutely. So the company was founded almost 4 years ago. We launched the service 3 years ago, which is what we're celebrating. And entrepreneurship every year is like, it's like 7 years, right? It's like dog years. It's certainly not for the faint of heart. It's an amazing journey, but it's not smooth sailing. And we've been fortunate to have the success that we had. We're delivering a great service to small business owners, and so far we've funded over $200 million to small businesses and originations, and we are on track to fund for 2017 alone. We're set to originate about $500 million, and we're very happy about that, being able to provide capital to small businesses.
How much of that $500 million you're thinking about funding in 17 is going to American small businesses?
It's all to American small businesses. We are 100% focused on the U.S. right now.
Wow. Why are people coming to you?
Well, you know, first of all, in the U.S., there is a problem. There is a credit gap for small businesses. If you're a small business owner and you try to get a loan from a bank, you know how hard it is. First,
yep.
Only one out of five small businesses is able to secure a loan from a large bank. And then even so, it takes months on end to get a loan or to get the capital that you need. And if there's one thing that business owners know, that time is precious. You don't have a big staff working for you, and you don't have that time. And many times, unfortunately, you don't have the luxury of planning months ahead for the capital that you need. And so that is what we provide. We provide very easy, very fast, very flexible access to capital. So small business owners can get them funds they need to grow their business, to manage payroll, and they don't need to worry about this long process, which can end up without even getting the capital. So, you know, that's what we do.
So would you consider what you do based on the clients that you work with high-risk lending?
Actually, no. I don't know what exactly high risk, what the definition is, but our customers, most of them are actually in a good position. They have good credit, they're growing fast, and they need to access capital. Actually, our loss rates aren't high. We're not looking to fund. Sometimes we have business owners that their business is, you know, in a bumpy situation, but for the most part, our customers are not in a distressed situation. We are actually funding, helping them access capital for working capital, mm-hmm. which is the majority of the need of small businesses today. Most small businesses don't need large amounts of funds to buy something. They actually need working capital financing to buy inventory, to bridge the gap between the time that they get paid from their customers. They might have a pinch when they need to make payroll. And so that's the capital that we provide. We have two products. We have a business line of credit, and we have an invoice factoring product. Both of them serve this exact purpose.
And what would be your typical loan size?
So we have our business line of credit, where the credit lines range from $5,000 up to $100,000. And our invoice factoring product starts at $20,000 and goes all the way up to $2.5 million. So
wow.
The business line of credit, we see typical credit lines at around $20,000 to $30,000. It's
mm-hmm.
a very flexible form of capital. You can draw upon it whenever you need, and it's always there for you. It's kind of like a security blanket.
Yeah.
And then our invoice factoring product really scale. So if you need to access more capital, and I'm not sure how many of the listeners are familiar with invoice factoring, but you basically take advantage of the fact that your customers have, you know, more credit than you or have a higher credit rating than you, especially if you work with larger customers, and you can tap into more capital. And so if you are really growing fast or if you have expenses where you need to tap into more capital, invoice factoring is a good product for you. And invoice factoring, our typical credit lines today are around $100,000.
So what kind of companies, businesses, are working with you today?
A very wide range. In our business line of credit, pretty much any small business that has, you know, we look when we provide the capital, we do look, we are a responsible lender. We do want to make sure that the business can make, can make do on their obligations. And so, but it's relevant for any small business, right? And so our business line of credit is really mass market. We have doctors, we have restaurants, we have marketing agencies. It's really kind of the full spectrum on the business line of credit. With our invoice factoring product, as I mentioned before, it is really a great way for businesses that have long outstanding invoices with larger customers that they can tap into the credit strength of their larger customers. And so First there, we would work with businesses that only have business customers. So it's only B2B. We wouldn't invoice factoring is not relevant for business-to-consumer type businesses.
Okay.
And so there, as you can imagine, it's ones that work typically with larger businesses. And so it could be wholesalers, manufacturers, business services. And so there's also a wide range there, but it's mostly for businesses that work with other businesses.
Are you considered a commercial bank?
We are not considered a commercial bank. We are a non-bank financial.
You're a non-bank bank.
You might say that.
Right. You don't take deposits, I assume.
We do not take deposits, right?
Okay, and so you're in essence a finance company that's providing capital, and so you're not subject to the federal banking regulations. You might be subject to state regulations, but not subject to federal.
Yes, we're not subject right now. We're not considered a bank.
Okay, and typically, what does it cost to do business with you in each of the two different products?
So there's a kind of a wide range of pricing, which it depends on the size of the credit line and depends on the specific circumstance. We, in our business line of credit, we price as low as 6%, around 6%. If you think about kind of cents on dollars, if you take a draw, how much you're expected to pay. And then on our invoice factoring product, we go as low as 1.2% per month. And so if you finance an invoice, then and we buy that invoice, with invoicing it's slightly different than a line of credit because we're technically purchasing the receivable from you. And so
right.
we would buy that at a discount of as low as 1.2% per month.
And that 1.2% is in place until the collateral has been paid off?
Precisely.
Yeah, and I don't want to overcomplicate things for our audience. Is that a present value discount, that 1.2?
It's a nominal value. The way it works technically is you want to fund invoices. You're trying to access capital by turning basically that invoice into cash by releasing the funds in that invoice. So
right.
Let's say you have a $1,000 invoice. We would advance you either 85% or 90% of that. So we would give you, for this example, $900. And then when your customer pays us that full $1,000, we would keep our percentage, let's say it's a percent. So we would keep $10 and we would remit the difference back to you, which is
right.
You know, kind of a nice benefit. You get that $90 back. So overall, you would have paid $990. Sorry, you would have gotten back $990. You would have paid $10.
So let me move to another part of your business. Don and I started this program because we believed that there was an opportunity that when Mr. Trump was elected president, we felt that a great many of the constraints that has stopped business expansion would be lifted. And there's been a lot of rescinding of regulations that have had an impact on business. What do you think from your standpoint, if you're looking at $500 million of funding this year, what do you think is going to be the prospects for 2017, 18, 19 for new business formation and new customers for you?
You know, I'm not an economist, and it's a little bit hard for me to look into a crystal ball, but I'm hopeful, right? You know, it's, small businesses are the backbone of this country. They create jobs. They certainly drive the economy. And so I'm very hopeful. We are seeing that both companies like ours and banks are actually providing more credit to small businesses, and that is essential for them to grow. And so I'm very optimistic about these next 2 years. I hope that the current trend will continue, and we will see businesses get formed at a higher rate, and we see the businesses that are already out there succeeding.
Well, we think there's an opportunity for expansion. We know, for example, that when he signed the Keystone Pipeline, the early estimates was that's going to create 28,000 new jobs on the pipeline, but as many as 75,000 ancillary jobs in support companies to the pipeline installation. So that's 100,000 jobs. And we know that the statistics say that growth in employment in the United States comes from small business, not from big business. And so I would think that you would be looking at opportunity. And with that, I want to say thank you so much for joining us. Why don't you give our listeners one more time the website of how they can get a hold of you, and tell us where we can reach you.
Happy to do that, and thanks for having me. We, as I mentioned before, we are 100% online, and so you can find us on bluevine.com, BLUEVINE.com. Everything you need to know how to get in touch with us is there, and we are looking to serving more and more small businesses and helping them access the capital they need. Again, thank you for having me on the show.
I thank you, Eli. And now it's time for a word from our sponsors. We'll be right back after this message.
Don't let hackers get your data. Email is insecure and can't handle large files. Instead, use BISCOM's Secure File Transfer product. Military-grade security that's as easy to use as email, and it can handle attachments of any size. Visit BISCOM.com for your free trial and make sure your private communications stay private. That's BISCOM.com.
Well, we're back. Don, tell us about our next guest.
Well, I'm really happy to have our next guest. I've known Mark a long time. I've watched, we've invited Mark Pfister to join us. He explains the importance of board leadership and support in small business growth, and he brings to this program a wealth of experience. Mark, welcome to the program.
Don, thank you so much. A pleasure to be here with you.
Mark, we get started, why don't you give us your website and tell our listeners how they can get a hold of you?
Sure. The website is integralbg.com, integralbg.com. And you can find my profile and my contact information on that site. We are a fully built and for hire board of advisors that has basically formed a new industry called a board as a service. So a privately held company can basically overnight have a true board of directors operating as a board of advisors service for them.
So you actually you provide a standalone board of advisors for a new company or a company that's expanding, and they need to put some other people in place in order to satisfy bankers or other people?
It could be looked at that way. Some of the companies we work with are in the earlier stages. So if they've reached that $5 million mark or the $10 million mark, and they're looking to go a little more formal in their approach. And there are other companies that have made it, and I'm talking in the private sector right now, that have made it. So they're either family businesses or they're looking at transitions for their businesses currently in terms of succession planning. And they're looking to really formalize the whole board process, the oversight, the leadership, the strategy, and the guidance. So this offers them basically a one-stop shop of forming a full board that has all the different expertise areas needed for their team. And again, they can have it overnight.
So how did you start this business?
When in the past, I've been an entrepreneur for most of my career. And there were certain points in my companies when we had landed some pretty large contracts that were, in some cases, doubling the size of our company. And at that time, I said to myself, I know that for the next 2 years, we're going to be very tactical in our approach. Not as much time is going to be focused on the strategic side of the business, which is really hurtful to a business, even though you have the business coming in and you're working and you're growing. You're not really doing your company any favors in the long term by skipping a year or two of focus on strategy and some of the other growth mechanisms. So many years ago, I started to look into if this type of service existed. And really, the only things I could find were groups where they would piece together or cobble together candidates for you to put your board together. Really not a solution that would take the burden of the build and the strategy behind the board all the way to the governance angle and the oversight of the board. So we said that the thought process here was to say, how do we take all of that burden away from a business owner and say, look, we have all the areas of HR, finance, technology, sales, marketing. We have those experts on the team. So with having that team built, it really was something that we felt would be a really great asset to companies that needed that support but just didn't have the time and in some cases the skill set to build a board properly.
So how do you charge for your service?
There's really three main ways, and I think we've made this process and the decision point quite easy. My favorite I'll start out with is what I call my drastically reduced fee with a commensurate amount of profit sharing. So we understand that most companies are not going to be able to go out and hire a team of five, six high-caliber board members if they were to do this themselves. So what we typically do is we want to be known as a performance-based group. And the way we structured this is we said, let's see what your yearly budget can be to cover some sort of advisory group, or in this case, a board. But we'll help offset that and lower that cost with a commensurate amount of increasing profit sharing. And notice how I say profit sharing and not equity. We're not forcing companies to do two things. We're not forcing them to give up voting rights in their company because we're engaging as a board of advisors. And we're also not forcing them to give up equity in their business. We think those are the two biggest mistakes that a company makes early on, and they typically regret when they make those decisions early on. So many of our clients, they'll offer up equity on a vesting type of schedule that is matching to some sort of profit sharing, but we do not force that decision early on. And then for companies that are extremely early stage in a very early startup, we will do a profit-sharing model only. We try to keep those particular companies to a minimum just simply because of the effort it takes to get those companies to grow and all the structure around them. So that's the profit-sharing.
Typically, it's been my experience. I'm a registered investment advisor. I've been in the business almost 44 years. Read a lot of annual reports. And I've seen board compensation where they get so much a meeting, they might get options on company stock. What do you say to the entrepreneur who says, you know, if I go into a profit sharing kind of deal with my board, doesn't it have a fiduciary responsibility to the shareholders to look out for their interest? And is there a potential conflict in interest if they wind up being compensated based on profitability?
Well, I don't necessarily see it as a conflict of interest. I like to think that any board member or board advisor, for that matter, has a vested interest in the company or the companies that they serve to make sure it's successful. So to me, the larger of the burdens here would be to potentially put the burden on the shareholders to pay for a group such as a true board of directors or a true board of advisors that in many cases are not truly tied into any type of compensation that's based off performance. So we see a lot of this even in the public sector currently with much of the regulation and the requirement for non-executive directors, or the percentage of non-executive directors, to be part of these public company boards. And the main reason for that as well is that's the structure basically to make it a performance-based type of engagement. Now, it's always been that way for the most part, and there's a little more control over that, I believe, in the private sector. But our compensation model forces that even further to say that we are part of the solution for these companies, not just there as a consultant, a vendor, or just someone that's on the take, basically, regardless of how well or if the company does not do well.
I want to make sure that I understand your use of words. To me, a board of advisors is different than a board of directors.
That's correct.
Board of directors having fiduciary responsibility, but not necessarily a board of advisors.
That's correct.
Not true in your model?
Yeah, the biggest differentiator, and typically, is if you talk about a board of directors. Typically, the board of directors has two main functions that correlate back to its responsibilities. Of course, the fiduciary responsibility, which if you boil that down, it really comes down to the word of trust, in terms of trust looking out for the shareholders. And then the legal responsibilities, which also comes back to the voting rights. Now, a board of advisors does not typically have those two specific requirements. They don't have the fiduciary responsibility legally. And they do not have the voting rights for any type of decision-making that comes up. Now, we've decided as part of our company model, we started back in 2013, we decided we wanted to remove two of these barriers that would either be a specific struggle for a company, especially a small private company, to make the decision on, which is we do not want to overrule and come in as a voting group that's going to overrule any type of decision that the business owner makes. We want to make sure that business owner is still stays in control, and we train that business owner as basically the chairman of the board. Now, when it comes to the fiduciary responsibility, legally we don't have the fiduciary responsibility, but because we're performance-based, it does pull us back into making sure that we're doing our homework and giving the right advice to make sure that our financial and any type of strategy that we're proposing for the business is sound.
So in your cadre of personnel that you can bring to bear in your board of advisors, I want to give you two examples and then let you respond either collectively or individually. What I'm curious about is, again, this difference between board of advisors and board of directors. What would a board of advisors do, if anything, if they had to deal with the United or the Uber incidents?
Well, I would like to think, first off, that our team wouldn't have those types of issues, and I view those as significant culture issues. And I can say some of the folks that are on our team, especially that are board directors for Integral Board Group, but act as board advisors for the companies that we serve. I personally view it as still a responsibility in terms of our model, whether we call ourselves a board of directors or a board of advisors. We still have full accountability and oversight as it pertains to the structuring and the building of the aspects of that culture of the organization. We're seeing a lot of this now where, regardless of whether it's the direct responsibility of a board director or a board of advisor, this culture issue has been a topic for some time. And we start to see this in groups, especially in these unicorns, so-called unicorns, as they start to grow. If that cultural foundation is not correct, you will see this just exacerbate throughout the organization. I don't view our business or our engagement as being outside of that responsibility, quite frankly.
The senior officer at Wells Fargo lost his job because of business practices within the bank in terms of opening up fake accounts, not in the best interest of the shareholders and for the depositors in the bank. Are we seeing an escalation of detached business leaders from the reality of the environment that they're working in, and does your board of advisors help bring them back to reality?
Yeah, and we do see this fairly often, and I'll tell you more from the public work or the public board work that I do in my advisory and some of the seats that I'm in for that. What I view as the main issue is the following, and it's one of the mantras that I believe that every board member should remember, is that if they were to weigh their balance of involvement, they should typically keep a balance of 90% strategic and 10% tactical. And strategic, we know, is typically as it's applied to, say, a committee on the board, or actually specifically to the board member's seat. That's the strategic side. The tactical piece to this is the connection to the actual company. It's almost as if it's a skip level that is reaching past the CEO and into more of the management layer of the organization. Now, I'm not suggesting to bypass in any way or undermine the CEO, but typically how this can be done to keep a pulse on the organization is through the committee areas. So I'm a big fan of making sure that the committees that are formed, and this goes for public companies as well as private, that the board committees have input from different levels throughout the organization, and that typically allows for keeping a pulse on what's happening at the operational level to make sure that the strategy is applied in the proper way. So to answer your question, I typically view the committees as a main function and having a main support mechanism and transparency into the organization. And many of the companies that you're mentioning, they do not have that. They don't have a structure that reaches that operational level of the organization, and they are detached.
So what you just said would be more, again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth as much as I'm trying to clarify in my own mind and for our listeners. What you just described would be more of a board of directors as opposed to a board of advisors?
So the only thing, you'll hear me frequently not differentiate the two, because I at its core, I believe that regardless of the voting rights and the fiduciary responsibility we mentioned a moment ago, I view the responsibility above and beyond those two areas to be quite the same between a board advisor and a board director. I speak about this at length. I'm currently on a national speaking tour called Building an Effective Board for Your Company. And one of the things I show there is that whether it's a board of advisors, a board of directors, or some sort of combination of those two, I actually believe that the responsibilities of those advisors or those board directors are quite the same regardless of the voting or the fiduciary responsibility. They are still guardians of the organization.
So when I'm a small businessman. What are the triggers that I should be saying to myself, I need to think about some kind of board structure other than me and my wife? What are some of the triggers that people need to think about?
Yeah, I'm an advocate, quite frankly, and many that will hear this broadcast will laugh because they hear me say this over and over again. It is never too early or too late to form a board for your company. And again, that board could be a board of directors or a board of advisors. So an example of this is that the power of a team such as a savvy group or a board of advisors or a board of directors around even a two-person startup is absolutely incredible. Everything from the connections of the network that are brought to the table, the early structuring of the company from a scalability standpoint. Anybody that I speak to that's starting out, I start to get them along the thought process to say that they should start to form that board or that group around them immediately. And in many cases, I suggest that it starts out as a board of advisors and it can graduate into possibly a board of directors or some sort of hybrid of those two in the future. But I think it's a great...
I'm sorry, go ahead. Let's finish your thought.
Well, I think it's a great asset to the companies, especially at a startup phase, to start thinking that way. It's big thinking versus small thinking from day one. And the other thing that I see currently, and many, just a quick note on this, is that we talk about some of the largest transfer of wealth in history is happening right now with the baby boomer retirement. Mm-hmm. And what that really means is that the decision of a business owner, even for large established private companies, is do I turn this business over to my son or my daughter, or do I sell the business and not view it as a long-term annuity to my family? And that's for multiple reasons, right? Do they trust the skill set and the dedication of the next of kin? Is it something they feel they can do? We're noticing, and one of the angles that we take on this is that we are pitching this board service as a way to make sure that transition is successful, to start to chip away at that terrible statistic of, I think it's 70%+ of second generation businesses fail. We believe by having that board with a company of an established company at the other end of the spectrum, it could be super helpful to ensure the longevity of these companies.
Yeah, my second son is an investment banker and works specifically in the field of ESOP transactions and is doing a lot of business in businesses that second generation are not interested in the business, but there's a strong employee base that is interested in continuing to work and growing the business, and selling the business through ESOP is a way to deal with it. But I wanted to ask you one other question. Let's just take one business that I'm in, and that's the business of writing books. At what point in time? I've got four books out now. I've got two more in production, and which will be out in the next 2 months, which will give me six, which will be two children's books and four adult books. Then I have another children's book in working, and another thriller in production that would come out in sometime in 2018. And I don't have a huge amount of business in terms of tens of thousands of dollars. Am I a candidate for an advisory board, and what could they do for me?
I would think so. And I think the first question any business owner has to ask themselves is, where do I want to take this? There are plenty of folks that are fine and they're satisfied with the level that their business has grown to. They like their autonomy. And there's many businesses out there and companies that are single owner or sole proprietors of those businesses. So I'm not suggesting this is a fit for all things and trying to be all things to all people. But anytime a company says if it's in their top three areas that they're looking at growth, I absolutely propose that they get a team around them, and they can do it over time. It doesn't have to be a full team overnight. It can be grown. If as an example, you talk about sales and increasing your market share, it may be that you focus on specific advisors that have that experience and background and are focused on that marketing and sales space for you.
Well,
one of the analogies. Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the analogies I use in this, and it comes back to this timing of starting this team around you, I think you'd be quite surprised also, just as a quick side note, on the amount of people that would say yes to help you out, especially if there's some sort of compensation, even on the long term in the formula. But mm-hmm. I go back to some of my previous companies where one of my companies that I sold my shares of after 11 years of growing this business, I actually believe, looking back on that I probably could have done in 5 years what it took me 11 to do because I did not have that team around me at the time.
Yeah.
So I think it really helps to hold the business owners and business leaders accountable. It gives them the support, and it also creates the mechanisms around them for that expansion. And those three, that combination of those three areas is quite powerful.
Well, I'm sorry, I want to be in touch with you. Don, what do you got?
Well, I was going to ask Mark. I ran into a situation last night. Somebody was telling me a major real estate brokerage firm, which in northern New Jersey, in which the father died, the founder but died, and turned it over to a daughter, and the daughter lives in Virginia, and. She only operates it 3 days a week, and she's facing major competition. How would your advisory board work with someone like that to help them identify what to do next?
Yeah, and it's a great question, Don. I will tell you that I personally am an advisor to two real estate firms currently. And one of the things that's interesting is that many companies right now, if you boil them down to their core, regardless of what industry or vertical they're in, they're typically, and I view them all as marketing and technology companies. At their core, almost every company, and I can't even think of one right now that does not have some major component of technology and marketing and being having a strategy of that looked at it in a different way. So, Don, you know, one of the things I always like to look at is, what is the strategy of that company? And another one of my national speaking tours right now focuses on what's called the strategy of strategy. What does it actually mean? Strategy has changed over the years, and most companies are still working with outdated strategies that date back to the 60s and the 70s. That does not fit with the level and the speed of change today that happens on a very short-term basis. So I think one of the main things, and one of the things that really makes companies falter is that they're not updating their strategy with the times. It's no longer a 2 or 5 year strategy. It's good to have a longer term roadmap of that time frame, but strategy of the company, of any size company, should be evaluated on a quarterly basis. So for the company you describe, I actually believe, especially with the competition in that space, and I can state specifically in the real estate area, there's been some major changes, even with some of the changes that StreetEasy brought up recently, where you can basically buy a zip code and become the broker for that particular area and have all the leads forwarded to you. There's no need for the big guys anymore in that space. That's one example of a strategy in the real estate space that can totally change the size and the breadth of your firm, even a very small real estate firm overnight.
Well, that's true. But let me ask you the second one that came up over the weekend. See, I always deal in specific instances. in effect, many retail companies are now facing, as pointed out earlier on this program, they're in a mall where the big boxes, one of the two big boxes, have gone. How do you develop a strategy for a retailer with two or three retail operations centered on malls that are in effect dying?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, this is a topic of discussion on many of the boards that I sit on currently. And I will again say, you'll hear me say over and over again, Don, and I know from our long-term friendship, you've heard me talk about strategy many times. But I will tell you that the larger firms right now, especially when you talk about big box retail, they have to start thinking like smaller startups. There is no way they can compete with the how nimble a small startup can be. And I'm a firm believer at this point that overnight, or I should say over the course of a short period of time, a two-person startup can become a major competitor to an American Express or a Walmart overnight, just simply based off of the technology and the marketing approach, and that all comes back to strategy. We all know right now that Amazon has made huge headway over the past 5 years. I think they even said recently that it's the largest retailer in the U.S. or the largest clothing retailer in the U.S., which is a major competitor now, of course. So I just think this has to be looked at differently. It's no longer the size of the business that matters. It's strictly the strategy and the leg up those companies get through some sort of strategic approach.
That's a powerful statement. But Dan, we're running out of time. Mark, your website again and how people can reach you?
Sure. It's integralbg.com, integralbg.com. You can see some of our services on there and how we help businesses of all sizes in the private sector. And I'll also throw in a quick update to my speaking tour this year. It's called Building an Effective Board for Your Company. I speak at everything from trade shows to advisory groups to colleges to you name it. I've been at so far this year. So it's another way of – it's basically a lecture and a workshop of understanding all of the ins and outs of creating a board properly. Touching on every aspect of selecting the right folks, creating your own strategy, building your sphere of influence, and also what I call your planes of congruence, which are the added value areas of having a diverse team on your board.
Mark, thank you so much for being with us. I learned a lot. I hope our audience did as well. Now a
thank
word
you,
from our
enjoyed
sponsor.
It.
Hate your old fax machine? You can now fax through email. Simply write an email, attach the document, and send. Works with all major email providers. Get rid of the noisy and expensive old fax machine and try Biscom's Cloud Fax. Our solutions are great for businesses of all sizes. Visit Biscom.com for your free trial. That's BISCOM.com.
Well, Dan, you get the last word.
Well, we want to encourage people to go to our website, recalculating.biz, where you can see past programs and you can see contact information on guests that have been on the program. And you can listen to us again with a whole new show on Thursday evening on AMFM 24/7. So for now, this is Dan Perkins.
Well, this is Don Mazzella, but also we encourage people to listen to their local radio station, 30 markets across the country, for our new one-minute update, which starts this coming Saturday. We'll post the listing on our site.
Take care. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for joining us on Recalculating. We hope the information you received on today's show was helpful to you in starting and growing your business. Please go to our website, recalculating.biz, for past shows and special offers. And until next time, remember, if you grow, we grow. Join us next week for more helpful ideas to make your business a great success.